already working in a mission field, or maybe they weren't. Maybe they were going out for the first time. They should be commanded by A Assembly because that's the place where they're known. But there is some reason, moral or otherwise, why that assembly would not give them a letter of commendation. And they went to another relatively nearby assembly and got a letter of commendation. That is dreadful. In one case where even a moral question was involved, but this original assembly and the assembly, a large assembly with good knowledge because the problems had taken part in their area, but when they were couldn't get a letter of commendation, well, they said, we want this thing tidied up. We want to see this whole question cleared up, confession or whatever it takes. No, we'll go to this little letter, this little assembly up the country, and sure, they gave them a letter of commendation, that they went. That makes a total farce of the whole question of letters of commendation. It is wrong, absolutely and definitely. If one assembly won't commend a person for a good and valid reason, for another assembly to do it is terrible. All right. Is there anything else on this question? Or can we get back to Timothy for it? We've used up our break time, by the way. Sorry about that. You can starve till 12:39. All right, let us look quickly. From the moment, that is the moment of his commendation, he was the most constant and intimate friend, companion, and co-worker of the great apostle. His name occurs in 9 of Paul's epistles, and in 6 of them, he is deliberately associated with that of Paul and his senders. That is, Paul writes the letters as Paul and Timothy to the church at so-and-so. So his name occurs coincidentally in 9, but in 6 letters, his name is deliberately associated with that of Paul. Though he was relatively young, physically not robust, 1 Timothy 5:23, use a little wine for thy stomach's sake, and thine oft recurring illnesses. They weren't just little things. He was not a robust person. Thine oft recurring illnesses. He probably, or I shouldn't say probably, he possibly was the prototype of a preacher with stomach ulcers. He was a nervous, retiring type of individual, probably unduly overawed by these things. See 1 Corinthians 4:17 and 16:10. Now, one of those references is, I hope to send Timothy to you. If he come, see that he is among you. I have to look it up. What's the word? See that he is among you without... In other words, he's a sensitive fellow. Treat him gently. It's probably 1 Corinthians 4:17, I would think. And these Corinthians were a pretty gassy sort of people. It's 16, no. 1 Corinthians 4:17 or 16:10. So get it wherever you can. 4:17 is probably the one about the...
16:10.
All right, what is it? Read it.
Without fear.
Oh, yes. Let it see that he is among you without fear. In other words, we get the impression throughout that he was a very sensitive person. Paul writes to him in his second letter in a way that he never wrote to Titus, for example. And he says, don't be ashamed. Don't be ashamed of the gospel or of me, his servant. Stir up the gift that is in me. He was a person who would withdraw quickly. He was a sensitive person. You don't get any comments like that, for example, in Titus. Titus would appear to have been a more robust kind of a person. 1 Timothy 4:14, 5:20. You can read these up yourselves. They are all indications that Timothy was a sensitive person, easily hurt, subject to sicknesses, and he was left, by the way, or sent by Paul to various places. He was entrusted by Paul, the middle of that paragraph, with the most important jobs to various local churches at moments of great crisis and need. He was sent to Thessalonica, he was sent to Corinth, he was sent to Philippi, he was sent to Macedonia, and he was sent to Ephesus. And the references are all given. Now, what does this do to the theory that Timothy was the minister or the pastor at Ephesus? He was sent to 5 or 6 different places for brief periods, and then Paul says, when I send so-and-so to you, that's the end of the Timothy letter, when I send so-and-so, you meet me at such-and-such a place. So he obviously moved around quite a bit for Paul and with Paul. At the end of his life, he is the man whom Paul most wants with him and for whom he sends. And he mentions that no less than 3 times in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Do thy diligence to come unto me before winter. Do thy diligence to come to me quickly. When you come, be sure to bring the books and the parchments, the things that he would like to have brought to him. I often think, you know, it would be nice if we could develop the character, the usefulness, the nearness to other people so that in a time of need, they would want somebody like me near them. Or am I the sort of person who, if they heard I was coming to be with them, would say, oh no, not that. You know? Now you can, I'm sure, think of people that you wouldn't want with you at the end. But wouldn't it be nice to be a person like Timothy? That when somebody is in the crunch, the ultimate hours, they say, Timothy, please come. I would like to have you with me. A microphone.
No, we're trying to let you get the hour in.
All right. Number one, we're talking about the lessons of faith. The lesson of obedience to the call of God. Now, I don't think I need to enlarge on that, do I? If there is no obedience to the call of God, there will be no Timothy afterlife. Just as simple as that. The lesson of obedience to the call of God, to whatever or wherever and whenever it might be. Somebody said, well, I don't feel called to go to China. And the missionary said, well, do you feel you have a call to stay in New Jersey? I mean, you have to have a call to be wherever you are, even in New York. The second one, the lesson of subjection to elders and a senior worker. That same Acts 16 with Philippians 2:22. Timothy listened to his elders, and Timothy was guided by his senior worker, if you will. Surely we're not so completely swelled-headed that we think that we know everything, that we would look to someone who is more experienced than we have and be glad of their advice and listen to their counsels and not say, well, I'm a commended worker just as much as you are, and I don't, you know, I can solve my own problems. I mentioned before how much I thank God for having served my missionary apprenticeship under the man that I did. Now, he never once was bossy, never once. But I just learned from him. We prayed together. We tramped together hundreds of miles through the villages. We tented together for weeks on end. And mind you, things rub very thin when you have no outside life. You're cooped in with the same three people within the confines of a mission station. No other white people within 7 or 8 days walk of you, and walk was the only way you had to go. There's a good deal of you have to make adjustments. C.F. Hogg, you of course wouldn't know him, but you may have heard of some of his books. If you can get any of his books, they're worth their weight in gold. C.F. Hogg. He once said, you know those beautiful, smooth little stones that you see on the beach? You know how they got that way? They got that way learning that they weren't the only pebble on the beach. They got that way rubbing with other pebbles, and gradually they became smooth. We get the corners knocked off us, and I suppose most of you have, like myself, had a few corners on you that needed knocking off. And if you don't get them knocked off the easy way, especially if you go to a place like Africa or a similar place, you will certainly get them knocked off you the hard way. So it's better to take it the other. Here's the subject to elders. Willing to listen to elders, willing to accept guidance from an older worker. Now, three, the lesson of acceptance of the unpleasant for the good of the work. In Timothy's case, this was circumcision. You will, of course, remember, do I need to remind you that in those days there were no anesthetics? Not only was this a painful thing, but it was a rather humiliating thing. And Paul suggested, for the good of the work, for your acceptance among the Jews, I think it would be a good thing. And he submitted himself to that. I think we should always be able to listen to advice about things that perhaps we should deal with in our lives, however painful, if we're going to be successful workers for the Lord. And somebody says to us, you know, some of the things you're doing, or this little thing you're doing with excuse me for speaking so often about Africa, but I know there. I, for example, had to take one of our dear sisters, or she came to me one day up in the air. She had before she came, the brother, an African brother who worked with her in the clinic, came down to me. He had thrown off his white coat, and he came down and said, I'm sorry, I've come down to tell you that I'm resigning from my work at the clinic. I said, why? Well, he said, so-and-so accused me of stealing in the clinic. Now, this man was superintendent of the Sunday school. He was an elder. And he said, I'm not guilty, and I think it was entirely wrong. And, of course, our Africans do not take a thing that they will take from a man, they would be less ready to take from a woman. And when it comes to an older man, they have great respect for age. So I said, listen, Roger, you go home like a good fellow. Now, he wasn't a kid. He was a man of maybe 35. So I said, you go home, and I'll talk to her about it. Of course, in about 10 minutes, she came pedaling back on her bike and her eyes going like this, and she said, Rodriguez has left his work. I said, yes, he told me.
Was she a maiden home,
too? No, she was a missionary. So she came to me, and a great panic, and she said, what did he tell you? I said, he didn't tell me very much. He told me that you had accused him of stealing, and that he's absolutely certain before the Lord that he was not guilty. And so I just told him to go home and wait until I had talked to you. So she gave me a whole palaver, and I said, listen, did you really have proof that he stole this medicine? Well, no, but he was the only person who could have taken it. I said, here in Africa, that's not enough. I'm sorry. Well, what should I do now? I said, what you should do now is get on your bike and go down the road and apologize to that brother. Now, she wasn't exactly the kind of person who found it easy to apologize to anybody, but much less to somebody that she had accused of stealing and who happened to be an African. And I said, I'm sorry, but that's the way I see it. well. She turned two shades or three shades of white, whiter than she was before, got on her bike, and away she went. Now, he said to her, she said, "Now, will you come back to your work, please? I was wrong." He said, "All right." And he said, "Leave it to me. I'm an African. I know who was in and out of there. Leave it to me to settle this thing of who stole it." And within a couple of days, he had solved it and brought the culprit by the ear and said, "Here's the man." Now, I had to tell that worker, "You were wrong. The African was right. You owe him an apology." And I had it in the back of my mind that if she had not done it, I would have said, "And you should not go to break bread with them until you do apologize." And I would have said that too. So that she listened. And I'm glad to say that we worked on that particular center for just over 20 years. And in that 20 years, there was never once any kind of friction among any of the many workers that came and went and worked with us there. And I think we were the only mission station in Africa who could have said that. And that wasn't because I was there. Because we laid down some rules. We got together every Friday evening. We all had supper, you call it, the 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock meal together. There was a basket in the middle of the table, a little small basket, and the law was no talking shop. There were nurses who would want to bring up, you know, two babies died on me this week. No, no talk. The teachers, no gab about discipline in the school or whatever. In other words, leave all the problems of the work out. Friday is a relaxing night. Work as hard as you like other times. We had tea, we had supper together. Some of the ladies did their mending. I had built put together a record player and cassette player, or tape, we didn't have cassettes yet, with speakers. Some of us listened to some good music. Some went into our dining room and on a very, very short table batted a ping pong ball back and forward for a while. In other words, we relaxed and we chatted socially and we got to know each other closely. And these junior workers felt it easy to come and talk about their problems. And as I say, in 20 years, we never had ruffled feathers, we never had any disagreements, we never had any arguments or quarrels of any sort with any of our workers, which was something of a record. Oh, the basket. Anybody who brought any of their shop talk had to put 20 escudos into the basket. That was the equivalent of a dollar about. I have to keep myself straight here. I get so mixed up. 3:45. Now, as you know, we're going to have a session over, and I suggest that maybe we keep that free for something you might like to bring up. We have two sessions now. 3 to 3:45, 4 to 4:45, and then we have an evening session, of course. So it may be that there would be some things that you would have on your mind, or something, or maybe some theme, something that you would like that we occupy that time with, always providing, of course, that we get through what we're at now. So let's set our minds to that. Peter, the sifting of faith. This is a subject that I hardly like to take up in a way, because it's a very serious kind of a subject. And it's one that sometimes when God undertakes sifting with us, we don't like it. It can be serious. It can be a difficult one to handle. And I certainly would want to do it with all the gentleness that I can possibly conjure up. I may sound sometimes as if I'm harsh or something like that. I don't know. I hope I don't. But if I do, I want to assure you that I'm not really that kind of a person. I also don't want to appear to be frivolous. I like to keep things, especially in this kind of a situation, where we can relax, where we can have a smile once in a while, where we can keep it light. I also want you to understand that I thoroughly enjoy the person-to-person interchange. I also would like you to know that I have enjoyed these times very, very much with you. I hope you have too. Enjoyed, of course, as you know, people sometimes say to me at the end of a very solemn and sometimes very, you know, knifing kind of a session, I enjoyed that. I wonder what they mean by it. That's like saying to a dentist when he's pulled a molar out of you, I enjoyed that message. But this is, I find it even in studying it up myself, and I find it even in speaking about it, not that I've done it that often, but even sections of it, it's something that really we need to handle with care, with humility, and with gentleness. To sift means to separate the coarse from the fine, the authentic, useful, or relevant from the spurious, useless, and irrelevant. Peter, like all those we have considered, was a man chosen by God for a purpose and deeply conscious of that fact. In his life, God seems to have focused our attention on the process of sifting through which every Christian must go if the worthwhile is to be developed and the useless discarded. No grain of our being will escape scrutiny and processing if the end product is to be what God wants. In Peter's case, we may note the main, or I should have said, some of the main crises. First of all, the sifting of Christ's call. The references, of course, are very well known. John 1:35, Luke 5:1-11, Matthew 4:18. Now, you will notice that there's a variation in the emphasis, and it would seem to me, at least, though I could be wrong, of course, I have been known to be wrong, it would seem that there was either more than one calling or that we are getting it in sections. I don't think that God the Lord, our Lord Jesus Christ, walked up to these men working around their boats and said, "Follow me," and they followed them, and that was all there was to it. I would believe that these were men who were part of the remnant of Israel who were looking for the coming of Messiah, as was Anna and Simeon and the rest of them. Now, this remnant, I am a very firm believer in the truth of a remnant throughout. I think it's in this book that you have been so generously given, and I said if it had been my choice, I'd have made you pay for it. But CMML has undertaken very generously to do that, whether that was out of mercy on me to get some of the books off their hands or not, I don't know. But as long as the money gets back and John Ritchie knows that somebody's buying the book, it will be a help. I have said somewhere in that some very strong words about those who these days sneer at the very words, the remnant. How they can do that, of course, I don't know. You'll find the passage, I'm sure. Because the Word of God is simply full of this. wherever we go, from the very beginning to the very end. To the rest I say, and that's the remnant, even in the letters to the seven churches, wherever you go, however bad the failure may be, God will have his remnant people.
Amen.
We find those, of course, as the day star drew nearer. They were watching for it. A man that you may be a bit surprised about, my even bothering to mention, is F.W. Farrar. To read his books, even if you disagree with something, some of them, would undoubtedly help your English, because he has a very fine way with words. He's a lovely writer. But he has a whole book on the time leading up, the dawn of Christianity, I think something like that he calls it. And I think I have most of the things that he has ever written. And he points out that not only in the Israelitish world, but that throughout the whole world, and he quotes from secular classical writers, at the time of the coming of Christ, there was a feeling that something great was going to happen. Men were seeking for something. In other words, they felt their society was going to bits. And in the Roman world, in the Greek world, and even in some of the pagan societies, men were writing and thinking about some kind of a deliverer. And that God was shaking hearts. Those men coming from the East, for example, were they just some Johnnies who were standing around and God told them, you know, there's a star, go follow it? I don't think so. God was stirring. God was moving. And so even today I find unconverted people, secular writers, half-time they don't know what they're talking about, but they see the total failure of our society. And they say there has to be a crisis of some kind coming. And I wonder if God isn't putting his nails into some of these people. Now, they don't know what they're looking for, and I'm not saying that they're prophets or anything like that, but they know that things are bad, and they're looking for some kind of a crisis happening. Great writers of history. Here I'm going to mention somebody, and I can't even remember his name now, but the man, Survey of History, the great professor of history, and it'll come to me in a minute. He said that he could see societies coming to a period of immense conflict, and that there would be a whole new setting up of world government before the end of this millennium. And yet this man professes himself to be something of a mild agnostic. In other words, we don't know, we can't know kind of approach. The desperation of man, your famous Henry Kissinger, for whom I have a great admiration as a man, a very highly intelligent man, a man who worked very hard to try to bring peace in the Near East and so on. When he retired from the political life and went back to be a lecturer at Harvard, he said words something like this. He, by the way, lectures in history. And he said, "I am glad that I am now a historian rather than a statesman. Historians can restrict themselves to recording the folly and mistakes of humanity. The statesman has to look for solutions. And I feel sure that there are no more solutions." Now that was a rather startling thing for a man like Kissinger to say. And many others too have said the same thing. Great agnostic philosophers in England, one of them said, "I can see nothing but suicide as an answer," and he committed suicide. He said, I see settling down over our present society a dark cloud of despair. But apart from that, the scripture is simply full of it. It was a remnant that went back to rebuild the temple in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, the Ezra and Nehemiah period. The Lord addresses the remnant, indeed, in many of the prophets. He's not just scattergun shooting, it's that kind of thing. He mentions the remnant. And I believe that God always has a remnant and always will have a remnant. He sifts this out. And so this whole product goes on, the sifting of the call. Where my mind was working was that I see these men as having had a consciousness. Also, we find that a way later on it says, he chose from among his disciples, he chose 12. So he had other followers at that time. He chose 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them forth. Now, you've been probing me and asking me about call and missionaries and support and going out of missionaries and things like that, and some have been asking me privately about how the Lord asked me to go, how I became conscious of this and so on. Here is a principle that we do well to pay attention to. Two reasons why he called them separately from all the other disciples. One, that they might be with him. And two, that he might send them in that order. Even when he was giving them the so-called Great Commission, he required them to go to a mountain in Galilee. And when they got to that mountain, and it was quite a long distance from Jerusalem up to that mountain, when they met him up there after a long journey and after a climb, which now you can do in a taxi up this kind of a thing, at the top it says they saw him. Some doubted. They were in some confusion. I don't think doubting, they said, well, we don't know whether we should really believe this whole thing or not. I don't think it was that. They were indecisive. They weren't clear. They were still a bit confused about the kingdom and so on, as we've learned from Acts chapter 1, wilt thou at this time restore the kingdom? So some were still unsteady. Some doubted. Then it says, they worshipped him. And then he sent them. And I suggest to you that that sequence is what I have been talking about. They
thou wilt find us always there.
Now, I hope that we didn't wander away from the question, because it was a very serious question and a good one. How do we distinguish if Satan is blocking the way? He may do that. But we also have to remember that God can and does permit Satan. Even Paul's sickness in 2 Corinthians 12, he said it was like a messenger of Satan sent to buffet me, but he recognized the hand of God in it when he said, you are going to take it away, Lord? All right, whatever you send is best. And so he recognized it. And what we think is satanic, I think God sometimes does this, maybe to show Satan that he can overrule him, and that even what he counts for evil, you thought it was evil against us, but God turned it into good, says the passage. All right, now in chapter 17, at verse 14, that's not, I'm looking for 17 in the 18th chapter, and that doesn't work, does it? Yes, Timothy is sent now. He separated from Paul after Thessalonica. He is left there. And then we read and at verse 14, immediately the brethren sent away Paul to go, as it were, to the sea, but Silas and Timothy abode there still. And they that conducted Paul brought him to Athens, and receiving a commandment to Silas and Timothy to come to him with all speed, they departed. And I have headed that as the lesson of separation from Paul and working with Silas. And that is something which must have been a test to that man. In other words, he didn't become what we might call a one-man dog. He loved Paul. He and Paul seemed to have been almost made to work together. And yet, Timothy learned to work happily and successfully with another worker. And I think there's a lesson in that for us, too. Then there's the lesson of suffering at Philippi. Now, we don't know to what extent he was in this, but he certainly had to see the others in the Philippian incident. But he certainly was in the incident at Thessalonica, and this was early in his work for the Lord. And then in Hebrews, the last chapter, which I mentioned the other day to show you that it was not an anonymous letter to those who received it in the first place, there's a mention of Timothy again. That is Hebrews, I hope, chapter 12, verse 23. Know ye that our brother Timothy is set at liberty, with whom if he come shortly, I will see you. So apparently, Timothy had been in prison. And whoever wrote the letter says he has now been liberated. So this young man learned to suffer for the Lord. Some of us like it when it's plain sailing, and some of us don't. We have to learn the lesson the hard way. Number 8, he had the lesson of working with an older man. Now, that is not always easy. Some older men are opinionated. Not that all younger men are not opinionated. But old men seem to be, are usually, I suppose, what we would call more set in their ways. And today we find, oh no, I don't want to work with those old fogies. You know, young people and young people work better together. We don't want to come to the weekly Bible study because we have our own young people's Bible study. I learned most of what I learned from the scriptures from people older than myself, not people younger than myself. I sometimes illustrate this by saying, supposing I, who know nothing whatever about, let's say, nuclear physics, nothing, total ignorance. Supposing I'm a young person, supposing I get together with a group of others and I want to know something about nuclear physics, and I don't know anything about it and they don't know anything about it, but we say, well, we'll bat it around among ourselves for a little while and we'll learn from those mutually ignorant. Now, I think that this is a case not of learning, but a mutual sharing of ignorance. There's no way we're going to. I mean, we wouldn't do this in anything else. If we need help with mathematics, we go to somebody who knows something about mathematics. If we want to know something about nursing, we go to somebody who knows something about nursing. If I want to know something about the roads of Pennsylvania, I go to somebody who knows about the roads in Pennsylvania or Virginia or wherever else. I don't go to somebody who's as ignorant as I am and say, well, let's discuss it. If we have a discussion about it, we'll come to some agreement about it. What kind of rubbish is this anyway? Where have we left our brains? We have to learn, and we learn from the people who know. Somebody who's been around the road, you can say, sure, follow highway such and such a number to interstate number so and so. I jot this down in the card and I stick it up in the front of the car and say, I'm glad somebody knew something I didn't. And I was so happy that older men took an interest in me, taught, showed me the books that I needed to read, led me into the scriptures, corrected me, every once in a while said, just watch it, okay? You're going a wee bit ahead of things. I'm glad of those men today. And I think that Timothy learned a lot by working with an older man, but it must not necessarily have been an easy thing for a younger man to work with an older man. But I think it's a divine principle. Yes?
I just had a comment. Henry Sardino, after he helped me establish me in a local assembly, he said, get a hold of the oldest guy in the assembly and grab hold of him and spend some time with him.
Yes, as long as he knows something.
Yeah.
Because you can meet ignorant old men as well as ignorant young men. Don't forget that. Yes, somebody who knows more than you do. That's it. Get hold of them.
Brother Long, I'd like to just present a different angle. I agree 100% that the splitting of meetings, they ought to be under the wisdom of the leaders and elders and so on. So I'm not trying to contradict that. I preach it. Could there be situations where we're not talking about where there's an established assembly and you're skipping one for another meeting, not at all. But could there be situations where these older men aren't available or they're not able, and the younger people get together, not in division from an assembly, maybe there's not even one, and they seek the head. They seek the, and they say, open unto us these scriptures, we're ignorant, and God can show them truth.
Yeah, I think that's a different thing.
Yeah, but that is a legitimate, under certain circumstances.
I think so. But we have to be careful even there. As long as it's not setting up an assembly within an assembly. I know of places now where the younger people don't go to the assembly. They have their own prayer meeting. They have their own Bible reading. They have their own Bible study, and you rarely see them at any other meeting. They'll turn up, maybe, at the gospel meeting, or the evening meeting, whether it happens to be gospel or ministry. Maybe they don't. But you'll see them when you're going out the door, they're coming in and going down into the basement to have their young people's meeting after the other meeting, but they didn't even come to show their numbers and their support at the older meeting. And I even remember a case, for I was in North America when it happened, when one assembly in California, and I don't think there's anybody here from California who can take offense at this. No, but in this particular assembly, the young people came to the elders and said, we would like to have our own breaking of bread. Now that really hit the elders like an express train. They said, what? Well, you know, we would like to have our own young people's breaking of bread. And they said, why? I mean, this is the very expression of the oneness of the city. By breaking bread together, we are expressing. Well, they said, we have our own prayer meeting. We have our own missionary meeting. We have our own Bible study. So why shouldn't we have our own breaking bread? Now, that shows it taken to the extreme. And once you get two groups, one assembly within another, it's a contradiction in terms.
Brother Long, what you say is quite true in the younger and the older. I think that is a rule in business as well as in the assembly.
Oh, yeah.
When I was a young fellow, I served my apprenticeship when I started when I was 16. And I worked with my journeyman, who was my superior. He taught me the trade. Mm-hmm. Until such a time as I became a journeyman, then I in turn took other young people under my wing and told them of my experience. Mm-hmm. So I think that rule stands also in the assembly, to learn, the young man to learn. And Timothy was the young man, and he learned from the older man. When I was first saved, I'm still being saved, I suppose, there was a brother who took me under his wing. We started in the open air. I preached in the open air and told all that I knew.